Hi, I'm Michael. Welcome to Beyond the Screenplay, the podcast where each episode we do a conversational deep dive analysis into a film. Today we are talking about Avatar, the 2009 film written and directed by James Cameron. I'm joined by the Beyond the Screenplay team, Trisha Rand.
Hello, everyone.
Brian Bittner.
Hello, hello.
And Alex Calleros.
Hi.
So before we jump in, letting you guys know that our patron exclusive for this month is going to be Avatar The Way of Water, or H2O, as I like to call it.
Or Avatars with a dollar sign.
The dollar sign that has so many names. It's going to get $2 billion for each name that we give it. So if you want to hear all of our hot take thoughts coming off the water presses of Way of Water, head over to the Beyond the Screenplay Patreon. to sign up.
Water presses?
The water presses.
You know.
There could be water presses. There's sure. No way to know.
You're right. You're probably
what's
right.
What's going to come?
There's going to be underwater printing presses in the new Way of Water movie.
Weirder things have happened in the Avatar universe.
You're not wrong.
Basketball has happened.
We're off. All right. So Avatar is, until very recently, the highest grossing movie of all time, $2 billion. Before that, Avatar, I knew it only as there's a new James Cameron movie coming out and it's going to be big and it's sci-fi. He's returning to sci-fi. It's going to be awesome and epic. And so I was like, I'm not going to watch any trailers. I'm not going to look at anything. I'm going to go in cold and be like, have my mind blown by this, like, hard sci-fi space adventure that we're going to go on.
Michael and I, we did this together, by the way. Like we're neither of us going to read anything about it. We're not going to know anything about it.
We went to the Metreon in San Francisco, which is, like, the biggest IMAX theater, at least it was back in 2009, in San Francisco. So, like, traveled out to the city to watch it, got there early so we could stand in line. And I was like, all right, let's do this thing. Hard sci-fi. I'm ready, James Cameron. And then there were blue people aggressively everywhere, running around, playing basketball. And I was just thrown so hard off of whatever, like, expectation horse I thought I was riding.
Just bucked you right off.
And I don't
that's
think
definitely a Pandora critter.
Yeah. The expectation horse.
The bond didn't take.
The bond did not take.
Oh, boy.
I was thrown, and I don't think I've ever been able to recover from that initial throw. It's generally how I feel about this movie. There's a lot of interesting things to talk about with it. It is very simple in its plot, and that is both good and a topic of criticism and conversation. And, you know, it was obviously hugely popular and hugely successful. I can't say it's a bad movie, but I also can't say that I love this movie, and I can't say why that is. And so I'm curious to talk about all of that with you guys, but kind of just curious to get your general thoughts on Avatar. Brian, do you want to start us off?
Yeah, you know, I was thinking as we were, you know, as preparing for this, I was thinking about my first experience watching the movie, and I can't really remember if I had, like, what my expectations were. I don't know if they were super high, but I don't think they were super low either. I mean, James Cameron just has this, like, weird career where he's made 8 movies basically, but he, like, waits several years and then makes Titanic and then waits, you know, and it's just like, okay. And I definitely saw it in 3D, IMAX 3D, I think. And, you know, that's the way to see this movie, right? Like, I was just like, I remember being the most surprised by just scenes of dialogue where I was just like, look how far away that door is. It's all the way in the back, you know, like, and I just, that, like, felt immersive to me. But then also during action scenes, I kind of didn't care that it was 3D. Cause it was like my brain was too overwhelmed with just watching the action and stuff. You know, normally when you're watching an action scene, your brain can kind of, like, miss every other shot sometimes, right? Cause it's like information overload a little. So then you add 3D to that. And I think it was just, I didn't feel strongly one way or another. And then I think not feeling strongly one way or another is how I feel about Avatar in general. Like, I, you know, I bought the Blu-ray when it came out, but I haven't watched it in 13 years since I saw it in the theater the first time. I think maybe I watched it like right when the Blu-ray came out. But for the most part, I have not like thought about it or watched it. And I think that's sort of everyone's experience is like 10 years later, we're all going, oh, right, Avatar. And you know, it's interesting to revisit something now with that much time behind you. And I think the movie still looks pretty good. And I think the story is still whatever, you know, and obviously like we're going to talk a lot about the writing and the story and just the plot in general. But yeah, it's just a movie that feels like what an achievement technically for its time, but also what a movie that just didn't really stick with me or a lot of people in any sort of significant way.
Yeah. Yeah. And the technical achievement cannot be understated. Watching it again, there were shots where I was like, this could not be better. This is a CGI shot that I don't know how you could make it better. And that is really impressive for something that's, you know, 12 years old, 13, whatever it is at this point. Yeah. Cool. Okay. Trisha, what are your thoughts?
Yeah. Generally very much agree with you guys. I'm going to come out of the gate here and say, this is a good movie.
Sure.
It's probably even a very good movie. It has a rock solid structure. It is incredible to look at. It's very immersive. For the most part, it's very entertaining. Watching it this time around, although I had retained, like you guys, hadn't seen it since 09, and had retained very little of the actual mechanics of the plot, beyond the very rough unobtainium, people want it, it's men bad, Navi good, and big battle. Like, other than that, I had kind of just, oh yeah, love story also. But like, the details of how it all unfolds, I absolutely had no recollection of. That being said, scene to scene, as I was watching it this time, I was like, yep, still on this ride, and like it's still moving, and honestly, like I'm having fun. I found myself really amped up during like some of the battle sequences near the end, and I was like, yeah, big pterodactyl, pull him out of the plane, throw him over there, yeah, get him. Like, I love it. It's great. There's so much about it that really works. And you get the sense when you watch it that the elements that are criticized often for being simplistic and or derivative are that way on purpose, right? And we can get into that. And so there's not a sense of like messiness or someone making a movie that they didn't meticulously engineer or want to make, right? This is clearly at every moment the exact movie James Cameron wanted to make and like opted for some, you know, this kind of archetypal myth story and decided not to complicate it with like really any sci-fi elements at all. He just really made a straight allegory. And I like, it's hard to fault that. That being said, I'm curious as to why it clicked with so many people at the time and then seems to have absolutely vanished from public consciousness. I wonder if the lack of IP is a contributing factor, right? And Star Wars, you know, you have a totally original story that is borrowing like very old, like sort of mythological forms in Star Wars, but then you immediately had sequels. So the universe was like pretty immediately expanding and stayed in consciousness for a long time. And then with other things like Lord of the Rings and Harry Potter, you have a piece of existing IP that people have already really loved and latched onto. So there's already kind of a fandom there that can sit and wait between movies and happily do that and things like that. So I think there's sort of an interesting like outlier here with Avatar where it's this richly designed, like very expansive story world. And yet, you know, 13 years later, we're kind of like, Avatar. What? Yep, there it is. But yeah, I mean, I'm like looking forward to diving into all of it.
Badoonks.
diving into the way of water. Water. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Great. Cool. Good. We're doing it.
Yeah. 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 All interesting points that I think, yeah, let's talk about right after. Alex, tell me your thoughts.
Yeah. I mean, I won't repeat what you guys have already said because I agree with almost all of it. I think the striking experience I had from that first viewing that Michael described in the IMAX theater in San Francisco was, you know, this movie presents some almost like anime wacky imagery to the audience in an otherwise like movie that is trying to be photorealistic. You know, you begin in these shots in space, this really cool looking spacecraft approaching a planet, signaling that this is a James Cameron like sci-fi epic. We get kind of the traditional James Cameron like marine soldier base and the typical cast of characters we see there. And then just very rapidly, we get to Jake Sully waking up in a cartoon body. And I just watching it again, I was like, he does not ease us into this at all. Uh-uh. We got a little preview of like an embryonic, like tank Navi and that's pretty weird. And it's like, wait, what? And then very shortly afterwards, we have a sequence that just feels extremely cartoonish in a way that even later sequences do not feel. Like, I think in the kind of Navi tribal world, things start to kind of feel, you know, like they all belong and you kind of are used to the aesthetic at that point. But there's this harsh transition when he wakes up in that avatar body in like the hospital gown and then just runs outside into this kind of like almost like college campus environment, like farm and basketball field and like people in avatar bodies like doing college campus things and running around and just like getting in the way
wearing
of people
human clothes
wearing human like, clothes yeah wearing like yeah. tank tops and shorts and yeah just that is such a hard turn and such like a like it's the kind of thing that you feel like your brain is broken because yeah. you just like the movie looked like a movie and that you like other movies you've seen. And then very quickly, you're now in this like strange animated movie that is also not animated, it's live action. And there's Sigourney Weaver, like in total uncanny valley, wearing a Stanford like halter top, like with an elongated blue face, like smiling a big toothy grin at me. And I just don't know what the hell is happening. And so this movie, I think, is just so. I just that in and of itself, I thought was just such a weird, fascinating choice for a movie that is so, as you said, Trisha, it seems like James Cameron is making exactly the movie he wants to make. The choice to not ease his audience into this like really almost like outrageous aesthetic is like one of the more fascinating choices in this movie. And by the time we get to like the midpoint of the film, I am fully engaged and I am used to looking at blue, tall, skinny cat people. And I am actually very immersed in the story by that point, but it takes me a while. And it was the same thing on this viewing where it took me a while to like just be watching a story and not just be totally distanced by the visuals.
Yeah.
So, anyway, that's my Avatar experience.
Well, it's interesting because what you guys were both just saying, I think is a little connected. I'm kind of connecting it in my mind, which is, you know, Trish, you were saying like it didn't have this like cultural impact like these other franchises. And I was thinking, if you think about The Matrix or something, it's like, what if you could unlock your mind in such a way that you could dodge bullets and you could come out into the real world and all this kind of stuff, right? Star Wars, what if you had a lightsaber and what if there was the Force and what if this, right? What if you could blow up planets with whatever? And Avatar is it's like, what if you could be taller and skinny and blue, right? Like there's not, and you know, you can ride a pterodactyl, right? Like there's plenty of cool things going on here, but it's not like, oh my gosh, imagine, right? Obviously for the character of Jake, being able to plug into an avatar is huge, right? He doesn't have use of his legs. And that's, you know, one of the more interesting things about his character design. But then what you're saying, Alex, it's like, even in the world of Avatar, he's like the, what, 50th person to do this, right? So it's not even special. It's like, it's right. Like, it's not, I think it would be really interesting if nobody had ever done this before. And then Jake is, for whatever reason, the first person who can do it. And then he goes out and then he encounters the Na'vi. And of course, they don't realize he's a human because how could they ever? They've never experienced this before. But instead, it's like, no, there's a whole bunch of them. They're out playing basketball. Sigourney Weaver's like hung out with them a bunch. Like, they, like, you know what I mean? So it's sort of like in the real world, there's not this big what if question that makes the world so fascinating. But even in the world itself, it's like what he is doing is nothing special, right? So it's not until, like you said, Alex, kind of the midpoint or something where you're like, oh no, now that they are under attack, like now I'm invested because now the story is different than it was before in some way. But yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there's a scale thing happening too. I think some of the roughest stretches of this for me are when humans are standing next to Na'vi. Where it's, I'm curious, like, to what
why?
Is that? Well,
I'm picturing the end when, like, Zoe Saldana
she's
is like
cradling.
I was with you. Like, you would have gotten me until I saw this shot, and now I'm. This is weird. Sorry.
Well, it makes me wonder, you know, there's a little bit of like science behind like Uncanny Valley thing about the human brain and what we like accept and what we reject. And I wonder if there's some science behind like scale things that we accept and reject, because this feels like it's an exactly some kind of perfect zone of bizarreness in terms of the scale. Like if they were bigger, like if they were 20 feet tall or 30 feet tall, we kind of like they're dinosaurs essentially or something. I feel like that would be easier in some ways. Obviously, you'd run into all kinds of other problems. Or the other thing I was thinking about this time around is like if humans were totally unable to interact in the environment with them at all. So it's like humans have to be like in a tank, in a spaceship. Like they get there slightly where it's like you have to be wearing a mask and like the soldiers are in their like mech things most of the time. But it's not all the time. Like humans can stand next to Na'vi, and that's one of the like things that my brain goes, nope. And like for some reason just can't make any sense out of, because the scale is like a little too close while also still being like just weird and hard to comprehend with me. And my eyes and my brain are just like, I don't know. I don't know.
I was watching this with my partner and she kept freaking out about the scale also, because all of the human things that they have are so huge also. Like they're big enough that it makes sense for the Na'vi to be climbing on it. But then you're like, but wait, the humans are tiny. So why are their ships so big? And like there was definitely weird scale magnitudes happening in this movie.
But I just want to go back to what Brian was pointing out, because it's such a good point. In most movies like this, you do have an audience surrogate, or you have the film itself is like an audience surrogate where, this is the first time this is being attempted. This is a breakthrough. This is unusual. It's, you know, when somebody wakes up in the first Avatar body, it's not the 50th and everybody's just like, oh, this is normal. Like it would be weird to the other characters because it is a new weird thing. And that would have helped a lot, I think, with just the transition for me as an audience member, if the movie like treated this as like insane and weird as it is. But instead, the movie almost was like gaslighting me into being like, no, this is normal. Like, just accept that Sigourney Weaver is Uncanny Valley, like wearing a tank top, like, and blue and tall now. Just like that, of course. And it was just, the movie wasn't with me. It was like just kind of like a freight train rolling ahead with or without me. And I'm just holding on for dear life, just wondering what the hell happened.
Yeah.
So I think to me, I think that connects to like exposition. And one of our patrons, Ian, made a comment when we asked, what should we talk about? He just wrote exposition, exposition, exposition. And I think the kind of what we're circling around here is that the Jake getting into the Avatar body isn't really the inciting incident. I don't think it's like it's him going off and then running into Zoe Saldana and like going, getting pulled into this other world. Mm-hmm. And so like all the things that I think one might expect to be part of like going into this whole new world, like going into an alien body, aren't actually like that's all set up so that then the story can start with this like you know, Jake getting pulled into the world of these people. And so I think that's maybe partially why so much exposition has to happen so fast, and the movie right. is treating this as like normal, because you, it needs you to think that it's normal, because the weird thing, the surprising thing hasn't happened yet.
Right.
And, you know, there's the beginning of the movie, there's a lot of voiceover narration.
Right.
Cameron Ceniceros made a comment about that on Patreon, of just there's reliance on narration kind of throughout, and like really aggressive like scenes where, like when they're recruiting Sam Worthington, it's like these two like cardboard cutout like agent people,
corporate standing, dudes,
right, standing behind him while he's watching his brother be cremated, trying to convince him to, like, that's all happening in the same moment, and it's right. like, I guess narrative, okay, I get it, but like that's a really weird thing for these people to be crowding, and anyway,
yeah,
so yeah, just that the beginning shoves a lot in to get you up to speed, because the movie hasn't even started at that point. Mm.
And there's a very pulpy quality to it as well. Like the voiceover almost has a hard-boiled detective right. vibe of like, he died for the paper in his wallet. You know, it's like, like, what genre are we? Like, what is the tone yeah. of this movie? Like, yeah, yeah. How serious should I be taking this? This episode of Beyond the Screenplay is brought to you by Mubi, a curated streaming service showing exceptional films from around the globe. Every day, Mubi premieres a new film. From iconic directors to emerging auteurs, there is always something new to discover. With Mubi, each and every film is hand-selected. It's like your own personal film festival, streaming anytime, anywhere. Right now, Mubi's library includes one of my favorite post-apocalyptic films, 2009's The Road. It's a bleak, gorgeous drama featuring an incredible performance by Viggo Mortensen and a haunting score by Nick Cave and Warren Ellis. The Road was a huge inspiration for a short film I directed the following year called Day 1000, so it was so much fun to rediscover this film on Mubi that inspired me so much. You can try Mubi free for 30 days at mubi.com/beyondthescreenplay. That's mubi.com/beyondthescreenplay for a whole month of great cinema for free.
Poorly written exposition, as you know, is when one character tells someone else something that they both already know for the sake of the audience. But yeah, like it's interesting because there's so many things kind of working either against the movie, or the movie is working against it itself, where it's like we have the narration, but the narration's sort of inconsistent. There's like a bunch in the beginning, and then it's like, I don't know, I think it's like an hour, and then suddenly like Jake will like say something to himself, like, oh right, there's voiceover in this movie. And then there's the exposition, just the normal exposition work of like, we have to have the characters say things to each other in a way that communicates something to the audience, you know, which isn't all poorly done. You know, some of it's, I think, done pretty well. And, you know, there's the like, remember, you got 4 minutes or else you're going to like this thing that you guys must clearly know from training because it's right. very important. I'm going to remind you. But then there's the problem of just like what was cut from the movie. So there's an extended cut. There's, you know, what, 40 minutes of extended scenes or something like that, which to Cameron's credit, he said the theatrical cut is my cut of the movie. There's an extended cut if you want to watch it, but it's like Jake on Earth and he gets in a bar fight and like, then he gets recruited and, you know, so it's, we are being brought more into the story slowly. But obviously this movie can't afford to take that much time to do all that kind of stuff. There's a lot of things going on at once. But what I will say in response to what Alex was saying is I do like that there's still so many reveals happening up until the midpoint of the movie. Like, so it's like we jump right into the Avatar body. We jump right into Pandora. But then it still does feel like every 5 minutes I'm getting a new piece of information. I'm seeing a new, like the world is slowly revealing itself to me. So it's like, oh, you can ride a horse this way. Oh, but now you can ride a pterodactyl this way. Oh, but now you can actually ride one. And now there's an even crazier one. Right. And then of course how he meets Neytiri and then how he meets the whole, you know, the family and everything. So I do think it's an interesting example of a movie that jumps right into it, but still does reveal itself over time. But of course, Alex, to your point, the big thing this movie needs you to buy into is the blue bodies, right? And it's like, if that's not the thing that it takes time to do, then that can just throw you off the horse thing.
The horse thing.
Well, and I think that this whole thing is about the ambition of the story and the ambition of the filmmaker, which is colossal, you know. Any other filmmaker might have tried to take three movies to do this one movie. Because of the reasons we're identifying here, mostly, you know, I think the phrase you used in the Matrix sequel episode, or I don't remember which one, Alex, was we need a longer on-ramp. And I've thought about that a lot, and the shortness of the on-ramp here is a barrier to entry, I think, for some, as we're identifying. But then also the voiceover is specifically designed to cut out the need for interstitial scenes, and unfortunately also eliminates a lot of character work that otherwise would be done through action. And so, you know, I was really bummed not to be able to spend more time with Jake Sully on Earth and kind of get to know who he is and how he felt about his brother. Like, his brother vanishes from the movie so early on and he literally never talks about him again. But the character journey, I think, could have felt a lot richer had we, you know, spaced out some of these plot beats in the way that we're identifying, and make Arrival on Pandora the inciting incident, you know, and make, you know, the long training, do a long training sequence where he's learning to use the Avatar body, like, and then he meets Neytiri at the midpoint, and then there's, you know, so, and then maybe there's like there's like a little skirmish at the very climax with the bad guys, and he kind of like picks sides in the war or whatever, but it's not the full battle over the Tree of Souls until the next movie or whatever. I think that there is a version of this movie that is spaced out over two or three films, two or three 90-minute-ish films, that might feel a little bit more like the pace that we're used to. But the ambition of the filmmakers here is something I do applaud. Like, there's a reason that this is an epic, as well as being like this classic myth story. And not epics are not just that way because of length, but they're that way because of scope. They're not telling the story of one person. They're telling the story of a civilization. They're telling the story of a huge, like, as we mentioned earlier, this is allegorical. This movie doesn't spend time making us care that much about Jake Sully, because this movie is not about Jake Sully. This movie is about us. And this movie is about our civilization. And so it's like, it's painting in these much broader strokes because that's what it wants to be, wants us to be focusing on. And so I think, you know, the things that people criticize about, you know, the lack of dimensionality in the characters or these other, you know, pacing things that we're kind of bumping on here, I think, again, they're a feature, not a bug, in terms of what the storyteller is actually attempting to do with the movie.
Mm-hmm. Totally. And I will say, just watching it again, you know, 13 years later, I am blown away by just like the ballsiness of the world building.
Oh, hell
and
yeah.
Like, and just like, and also the like earnestness of the message and the kind of literalization of these kind of Gaia new agey, you know, green kind of philosophy ideas, is like really bold and really like unusual to see in a big commercial product. And so I really admire Cameron for just being like, you know, I'm a Titanic. I can do whatever the hell I want. And I'm going to make my incredibly earnest, like, eco myth movie where literally the Earth is like a living neuronal network that people can plug their ponytails into. And like, I'm literally going to just do that. And I admire him for it, for just going for it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, I mean, again, another Patreon comment from our friends over at the Script Apart podcast is raising this point of like the simplicity and archetypal nature of the story is one of the most derided aspects. But as you're pointing out, it feels like clearly the right choice for this movie. Like, I don't think there's anyone that saw this movie that didn't get it, like get what it was about.
Yeah.
And both thematically and like at any like beat in the story, I think you're always pretty clear about what the through line is. And so you can then hang off of that this crazy sci-fi world building like you're talking about, the crazy visual effects and technological things that were being done, right? 3D, this made every movie afterward have to be in 3D, whether it was shot for that or not. But like it's doing a lot of things on lots of different levels. And so I do think, as we're saying, that having a simple, crystal clear story and theme does serve the movie in that way. And so that's why I think, as you were saying at the beginning, Trisha, I think this is a good movie. I don't know that it is going to ever be my favorite movie, but I can't knock it for many of the decisions that it makes to tell its story.
Yeah. And, you know, what you were touching on just a second ago, Alex, is something I've been thinking a lot about. So we recently talked to John Truby, author of The Anatomy of Story, which we have quoted a lot on the channel. And then he has a new book coming out, The Anatomy of Genres, where he kind of dives into, you know, sort of these big thematic ideas behind each of the sort of major genres that storytelling tends to fall into. It's a really fascinating book, and we had a great conversation with him. But his chapter on myth, he spends a decent amount of time talking about Avatar. And the interesting aspect of Avatar in its mythological form is that it is a myth, but it's not a myth in the type that we're familiar with or tend to be familiar with in Western culture. He was talking about, you know, Joseph Campbell, who he takes issue with, and the monomyth. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
He kind of takes issue with the monomyth as being this like unifying myth among all cultures. And Truby's point in the book and when he was chatting with us is that, you know, it's not the monomyth. It wasn't like the main myth form for many, many years. It is a myth that in modern times, and especially in Western cultures, has kind of wiped out all other notion of what a myth is. But this, you know, hero's journey, quote unquote, is the male, like sort of warrior myth and fantasy of like a divide and conquer, sort of like a chosen one comes and like defeats all of the enemies and like emerges triumphant in a great war or something. And he was talking about this ancient form of like a female myth, which is more about cycles and rebirth. And instead of dividing and conquering, the female myth is more about growth and community. And he was saying, you know, the female myth is essentially, if the male myth is divide and conquer, the female myth is combine and grow. And he was pointing out that Avatar, even though it has a huge battle at the end and like a kind of warrior king, if you will, in the character, that the philosophy of the Na'vi is very much that of the female myth, and that Jake's cycles of rebirth, right? He points out that Jake is reborn three times in this movie. That Jake's cycles of rebirth, first when he's born, quote unquote, as an avatar, then when he's like accepted into the tribe, he has like that sort of coming of age ceremony and he's sort of born again as like an accepted member of the people. And then at the very end, when he's like literally born into the body for permanently, he's saying that's very much the female myth. And the movie is supplanting the male myth, but with the female myth. And there is something very unique about that, even though there are story beats that here that feel familiar to Western viewers, that there actually is something very surprising about the way that the I guess denouement, as well as like sort of imagery and values of this myth come out in the themes.
I think it's something Cameron has always done in his movies, is there is this sort of like hard exterior kind of dude energy. And then there is kind of a softness there too, right? Mm-hmm. Whether it's Titanic is like this big ballsy action-y kind of movie, but obviously also like a you know, very much a romantic drama. And then obviously the heroines of Terminator and Aliens, you know, and Aliens being like about motherhood, even though it's a movie about a bunch of space marines kicking ass, right? So yeah, it's interesting to see that like when, I think a lot of times it's like those two things come together and it gives everyone hopefully something they can cling on to, whether you're more on kind of one side of that spectrum or the other.
Mm. Yeah.
You know, and thinking about how the movie ends, you know, like we talked about the uncanny valley-ness of that shot where gigantic Neytiri is holding little Jake Sully. But that's, it's a striking image for like, yeah, like one of the final images of our hero is, it's kind of like this baby and the final like shot of the movie is this like yoga ceremony around a magical like nature spirit tree to like rebirth him. That's very different than like you're saying, Trisha, like, you know, we wouldn't expect that from, you know, Star Wars is like, you know, dudes getting medals in like a war room.
Correct. Yeah.
And this movie ends with like a spiritual ceremony of rebirth with like a, you know, shaman mother guiding it. And that's unusual. We're not used to seeing that in the biggest blockbusters of Western filmmaking. And that's part of what was disorienting about the movie, honestly, was just like, wow, this is earnest and kind of mushy but cool and a lot of things at once, and it makes you uncomfortable but it's also kind of great. So it's part of why I'm excited for actually Way of Water is like, now that my brain's not going to be broken by these images and technology has advanced further, I am genuinely excited to see what Cameron does furthering these themes and just taking it wherever he wants to take it, because nobody else is doing this with this kind of money.
I mean, short of Piranha 2, The Spawning, you know, the last two other times James Cameron has made sequels have been Aliens and Terminator 2. So if that's to say anything about what Avatars could be.
Pretty good track record. Yeah, exactly. Well, and, you know, exactly. I think the ending, especially, as you're highlighting there, Alex, is where it really like leans hard into the female myth, right? Because when he comes out riding on the big red pterodactyl and he's like, I am the most powerful, hello. I'm the menace from the skies and I'm the only one who can do this, even though I literally was just have been in Navi for like 2 months.
By the way, like that was another weird, like I had no ramp for that moment either. It's like,
no.
Bring the voiceover back. I gotta do something real crazy, like jumping on the back of it.
I bet it never looks up.
Yeah. It's wait, was this set up? Like what? Where did this come from?
And now he can command everyone and he's,
Yep. So, and then he rides into battle against all the space marines carrying a gun is the other thing. I'm like, I'm sorry, you have a gun? Okay. Again, the scale. Why would he be as a Navi hold a gun? Okay. So I struggle with all of that. But, you know, the image of him, you know, with his body broken, he can't even breathe the air on this planet. And that's what he nearly kills him in the end. And then he talks about how, like, they didn't wipe out all of the humans. They just sent them home. And then he's like, you know, Taruk Makhta was no longer needed. And so the big red pterodactyl just flew away and I wasn't the big warrior anymore. And then I just became a Navi. And, like, he's a part of the people now and there's this sense of like, he might be the leader, but he doesn't seem to have plans to continue amassing power or to like go to other planets or rule all the tribes or, you know, there's this very sense of like, okay, we defeated the threat and now I'm just going to be among the people that I want to be among and like have a family. Right. And it's interesting that one of the few things we know about Way of Water is that he definitely has a family and he's part of this community. So yeah, the ending I think is where it really sets it apart. And of course the values of the Navi, as I mentioned earlier.
Yeah. Well, and I think that, you know, again, another patron comment from John Willis, who was talking about, you know, Commander Army man, whatever his name is.
What's his Quaritch.
What is it?
The Say character's it name is Quaritch. Quaritch.
Stephen Lang.
Stephen Lang.
But yeah, just like that, he's such like a like a cartoon character, almost like one dimensional cutout of like every possible stereotype that you could shove into this character. But I think that, again, like we've been talking about, that simplicity and clarity gives you something to hold on to. So if you are, and this is extremely, I guess, condescending, but if you are just like, dude, bro, and I want to go watch stuff, you have a very clear dude, bro, army person to signal the masculinity and make you feel comfortable that you're watching a movie. And, you know, you don't have to be worried that you're going to have thoughts and feelings or anything. So you have that to placate, you know, whatever defense mechanisms that might come from that. And I think the sharpness of that rendering, like I'm saying, can lower those defenses so that you can have this story that ultimately does kind of subvert and supplant and kind of starts feeling, I'm going to say conservative, but ends up being very liberal. Like it goes on a lot of places, and I think it's accessible and not distasteful for people, and just like how safe this like journey is, you know, he constructed this journey to be. And so just another example of, I think it can go to those places and end in those places, maybe because it has these anchorings and very clear familiarity things, so as to assuage any minds that might be freaked out, lest they think they're going to watch a movie that ends in a yoga rebirth.
Yeah. I mean, I think one thing I was noticing, it's like, yeah, there are these very obvious archetypes in so many of these characters. But I think one thing that takes away from that a bit is how quickly characters just swap their beliefs or their objectives out of nowhere, which kind of takes away from the archetype thing. So like you have Grace, you know, waking up, where's my goddamn cigarette? We don't need you. We need your brother. He's dead. I don't care. You think you just want to waltz in here? And then like 5 seconds later is like, oh, you're blue now. Have some fruit. And then, you know, the Na'vi are like, oh, you wandered into our thing. We're going to kill you. Like, nah, you know what? Let's teach you our ways. Right. And then later, like, you need to leave forever. Oh, you tame the red bird. Okay, well, you're fine. Like, lead us. And then even Jake, right? It's like, I love these blue cats. Oh, but you want to attack them, right? So here's the weak point of their base. Like, obviously, that changes quickly. But he's, like, so in love with them, but also so, like, no, this is my mission. I got to tell these guys how to, like, take these people down. And even with Quaritch, with Stephen Lang's character, it's like, there is that kind of cool surprise where it's not the third act, but it's, like, post-midpoint where suddenly the attack is starting, right? And like I, that is kind of a neat twist in the movie, but it also just feels so unearned because it goes from like this kind of heart to heart that he and Jake have, where Jake's like, no, just give me another day. I got to finish it. Like, I promise I'll be able to convince them and that kind of thing. And then he's like, now we found this video, you saying it's not going to happen. So we just order the attack immediately. And it just feels like these characters are just changing their minds about things all over the place. And I think that's what hurts, that's what keeps everything from feeling grounded to me sometimes. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think part of what I feel with this villain is that there is this tone genre thing where it almost feels like what I would expect from like a Saturday morning cartoon villain. You know, they like watching, I used to watch as a kid, like the New Adventures of Batman and Superman on like the WB. And it was like a well-written, well-done, like comic book cartoon series. But like it would have characters like this where it's like, this is just like the very bad guy who's going to have like one-liners constantly, you know, as they're bombing the Na'vi, we're going to keep cutting back to him saying like, oorah, like that's this is how it's done. Coffee. Yeah, right. Like
I want to be home in time for dinner.
Yeah, exactly.
Drink some meat tonight, boys. Like, yeah, and it's literally like those lines. Yeah.
That's what I expected in like the Superman cartoon. But like, does that belong in this movie? Maybe it does. Maybe this movie is kind of a cartoon, actually, and I'm not watching it in the right way. But I think, yeah, it's just it part of the disorientation I often have watching this film is the sense that like it has influences maybe from anime or from other forms. But like I am not mentally in the right mindset for the the kind of the strategies that Cameron is utilizing. Like, I feel like he's bringing in strategies from other forms that aren't like the big Hollywood summer blockbuster. And it just feels out of place at times. At the same time, like, it undeniably works. Like, you know, he is the bad guy and you feel that he is the bad guy constantly. So like, it is effective, I guess, in just confirming that constantly and making me hate him. But it feels like there's also, you can do that using other techniques besides just the cackling villain from a cartoon. Yeah,
I do wonder if the sort of caricature feeling that I get from some of these characters comes from a lack of any hint of any backstory whatsoever. And so, which I think is just a product of a lack of time, right? This movie, again, going back to the ambition of it and how much it's trying to cover, like, if you were able to really, like, even spend one more scene with any of these characters, there'd be a way to potentially visually signal or hint in dialogue about where in the hell they came from. How did they get to Pandora? Why do they care? I feel like we actually get this a little bit with Norm, the, you know, fellow Na'vi Avatar driver.
Nerdy kid.
Yeah, guy. The nerdy yeah. one. I think we get this a little bit with him, right? Where we get the sense of, like, he's been training for X, you know, however long, and I've been practicing my Na'vi, and I'm excited about this, and this is why I'm here. And we get a tiny bit of it with Grace, right? We're meant to care a little bit more about her. I think if there were some of that a little bit with the villains, it'd be nice. It would just ground them a tiny bit more. And I think that, you know, the movie isn't interested in doing it. And I wonder if also there just isn't time to do it. Maybe both. But I think there is something like, you know, maybe when we first got here, we were setting up our camp and we had a run-in with the Na'vi. And like, my commanding officer was killed right in front of me. And so, you know, something like that with maybe that Stephen Lang character or whatever, right? Like, you know, I've dealt with this situation before. I think he maybe does hint this or whatever.
It's like a little
mini. In the, like, here you are at the safety briefing. But just something along the lines of, I am personally angry about X. Right. And I have decided to take it out on the Na'vi. Even Giovanni Ribisi's character, I feel like, first of all, really doesn't work for me here.
I didn't know God he could talk him. Normal, like, I know, this whole time. He could just do this.
Right. Come with me. You see this little rock here?
It's like, yeah, Grace didn't know about this. She didn't know about the rocks.
That scene, the exposition in that scene, when he's like telling her what unobtainium is. I'm like, oh, she's never heard of it. I see. Right. Gotcha. But anyway, but the Giovanni Ribisi character, even that would be something like, maybe he inherited the corporation from his father and he has family expectations he's trying to live up to, or, you know, something, just some kind of personal reason why this is all happening, I think is missing for me. And again, maybe there just wasn't time. I don't know.
Yeah, I think this is really interesting because I think I would also prefer those things. But also, like you're saying, this movie seems uninterested in it. And
totally.
And I feel like in some ways, as you were speaking, I was thinking about the original Star Wars, A New Hope. And we talked a little bit about it on one of our Star Wars episodes, right? The What Is Star Wars episode, about, like, in the original Star Wars, it is pretty black and white. There's like good and there's evil. You don't really know anything about Darth Vader, and all the people in the boardroom are just British and evil, and they're the bad guys, and they're the Empire, and the rebels are good. And, like, it is very simple and black and white. And I think that has a strength, and I think that that's the case in this movie also, where, like, it seems like the movie doesn't want me to think two ways or have empathy for Giovanni Ribisi. There's like a shot where he like sees the tree blowing up and he has like a look of like maybe doubt. But yeah, so I think it's interesting that the movie is so uninterested in that, and that if one of these characters had suddenly felt grounded, it might have made everything else feel that much more out of whack or out of sync. But the exception to all of this, the place where I feel like there is depth, is in Zoe Saldana's performance. Like, for some reason, just feels like a completely lived-in, believable, whole character in 3D in a way that I don't feel like any other character, ironically, in this movie does.
Totally.
And I think if you're going to have a character that is that, I think it is important that it's her, as that is like the kind of the emotional connection through character that we have to the world of Navi. So I think that is interesting that that's how that all played out, intentionally or unintentionally.
And then going back to just like, who's the movie for, or like, why is he bringing in these tropes that strike me as kind of kid tropes? Like, maybe that's why. Like a lot of people saw this movie when they were younger than I was when I saw it. And I think it, like, if I saw this when I was 9 years old, it might have just blown my freaking mind and been my favorite movie ever. And I think it helps in that kind of a movie to not have confusing, complicated characters. You know, like I was imagining just now, you know, what would be a more interesting way to establish this villain's hatred for the Na'vi? You could have some like really brutal scene early on where we see a bunch of Marines get ambushed by Na'vi and get like slaughtered, and we don't know the Na'vi yet. So all we know is the fear the Marines feel, where they're all just getting like speared left and right and everybody's dying. You could set up like a legitimate perspective of, oh my God, they really are savages. They really are terrifying, and they are, you know, they will just kill us on sight. But then that wouldn't really be the movie for kids, that where like you can just earnestly love the Na'vi and feel they are like unambiguously the good guys. So I think the movie that I wanted isn't the movie that would have made $2 billion potentially.
Well, and to your point, I think I was reading a quote from James Cameron where he said something like, yeah, the movie cost $300 million. We couldn't afford to have a target audience. Like, right. Which is like, yeah, I see you.
It's for everybody.
It's interesting because we just talked about The Truman Show and how we like that it's kind of a fable that's self-contained and we don't have a lot of backstory, you know, but that's a 100-minute movie about one person in a very specific world and about that person sort of escaping from that world. And even that character, we do get a lot of backstory for that one character. And this is, you know, a almost 3-hour movie with a bunch of characters and a brand new world and two sides of an argument and one character switching sides. So it's like, yeah, it is also a myth, a fable, you know, but to your point, Tricia, it's like, but if the characters feel too two-dimensional, too wooden, then it just feels like, well, it's not even like a real story anymore, right? It's just a cartoon. Speaking of cartoons called Avatar, I'm so sorry to our patron Zach, who wanted to hear our take on Prince Zuko's redemption arc. I was not clear in the Patreon post which Avatar we were talking about.
I understand that reference as I started watching Avatar The Last Bender, Airbender recently. And I'm an expert on it.
He gets so drunk.
Yeah. Well, so why don't we continue this conversation in lessons? We don't want this podcast to be 3 hours long also. There is the moment you talked about earlier, Brian, where they attack early, right? And they destroy the tree of life, right? It feels like, I'm assuming that's the crisis point. I didn't really like stop and like
do home a tree whole or analysis. The tree of souls.
Because they bulldoze over some like special trees,
right? And that's where Neytiri is trying to
on the way to home tree,
right? Okay, but then they also destroy home tree.
Right? So there's like the ancient communication trees,
right?
Where they have sex brutal. For the first time,
or they have sex
in front of all their ancestors.
Yep. And then they bulldoze those, and then they go from there to destroy Home Tree. And that's right. Like, yeah, the beginning of that. And then there's a whole, you know, big regrouping before the attack on the Tree of Souls. Right.
And so this is a rare example, and it's really not a concern anyone needs to have, but I think it's just interesting to point out that there are occasionally in movies crisis points that are so awful that I disengage from the movie because I'm like, well, you already lost everything. Like, nothing really matters after this point. And the crisis should feel like that. It should feel like they're all hope is lost. Like, that's the whole point of it. But weirdly, some movies are so successful that I'm like, you just lost your connection to all your ancestors for forever and your home. Like, what are we even fighting for anymore? Like, it feels like you guys have lost. Like, maybe you can kick people off, but emotionally it feels so devastating to me that it's like, I don't feel that there's anything left to fight for. So I just think that's an interesting thing that can happen. And I don't know if that happens for other people at all, but it's a thing that has happened frequently enough that I think it's worth calling out to just have like as a little thing in the back of your mind that want to make sure there's still something worth fighting for and worth saving in your movie. And that's probably the case here. That's just how I felt about how this all went down.
But Avatar isn't a tree, it's a people. I think is what they say.
Well, and I think maybe part of it is there's just a lot to keep track of as far as like their resources, because like this thing is bulldozing over like soul trees, but there's like a main soul tree also that has not been bulldozed over yet, which I also lost track of. I was like, oh wait, that like the shiny white like branches are being bulldozed there. I think part of it is a clarity of like there's still the last outpost that needs to be defended.
Right. That's probably the most actionable takeaway, is that like, I thought this was the thing of like, if you lose it, that's it, game over. And so we already had game over. And then you were like, no, there's more game. And I was like, well, you just blew that on this previous thing. So anyway, that was one of my thoughts. Trisha, what's your lesson?
Yeah. One thing I was left wishing for this time around, and again, I'm not really sure this is a criticism. This just goes back to like the character design. So you mentioned earlier, Michael, that Neytiri feels like the most realized character by the movie. And part of it is Zoe Saldana, for sure. But part of it is we have a story about her relationship with the humans, right? She and her sister were there. They were going to school. Her sister was, you know, never took to it or was distrusting. And then there's this horrifying story where the sister was murdered in the doorway of the school in front of Neytiri. And so Neytiri's distrust of people and of humans and everything is sort of explained. And then we also meet her family, right? We meet her father and her mother. Her father dies. There is context for that character. And because she is the person teaching Jake the ways of the Na'vi, in her performance, we hear the reverence in her voice for their traditions, for their values, as she's explaining their values. I was really struck this time around about, you know, when she kills all those dogs that are attacking him early on. And
my dog was very upset by that scene. Started watching the screen going, what is going on?
And, you know, and he says, thank you. And she immediately is like, no, thank. We don't thank. We don't thank for this. They died for, they didn't have to die. Right. Mm-hmm. There's a personal stake for her in the traditions and the ways of the Na'vi. She is a physical embodiment of their value system. And I think that that is what part of the reason why she feels fully rendered, fully like, you know, we can understand everything about her when she speaks and how she feels at every moment. We know how she feels, not just because of the look on Zoe Saldana's face, but also because we understand what Neytiri cares about. Contrast this with Jake. What does Jake care about? I wish I knew. You know, I think that he's left a little bit as a blank slate on purpose. But it'd be nice to know what his value system is before he arrives on Pandora and meets the Na'vi. We get a little bit of like, I was once a Marine and now I'm still always a Marine, and it never really leaves you. And he had a brother. Again, we don't know hardly anything else about his family. Did he have a community? Are his parents still alive? Is he in touch with anybody from his past? Does he have neighbors? any old thing about, because what we're seeing, what we're supposed to be seeing, is why he falls in love with the value system of the Na'vi, in contrast to whatever his value system was that was unfulfilling for him in his previous life. And so if he really is unfulfilled by the value system of having been a Marine, and like, again, he feels, I guess we get maybe like he's abandoned by his government or the, you know, whoever sent him into combat. They don't want to fix his legs now, so they've just left him. We get a slight sense of that. But again, it's not, this is, I feel left behind. I feel betrayed by that. Or like, I want to believe in it. I want to believe in the cause that I was fighting for on Earth, in whatever war I was in. Like, I wanted to believe in it. I still want to believe in it, but it's never really rung true for me. It's never really left me feeling fulfilled. So I'm, you know, Neytiri is an amazing example of a crystal clear value system, and therefore an arc. So when she, you know, welcomes Jake in, we know how much that costs her because human beings killed her sister right in front of her. There's a sense of context and continuity for that character. And it's kind of missing with Jake. And I wonder if that's why he is not as memorable of a character for people coming out of this movie, where it's not like, you know, people walking away going like, I really understand Jake Sully, and like, he's such an iconic character, right? He's not, because there's that sort of lack of context around who he is, where he came from, what he cares about before he gets there.
Yeah, I think it's really interesting that it's for a movie that seems to be about clarity and telling its, you know, mythic story, it has all these, you know, symbols and ideas working at this macro scale, but doesn't seem that interested in rendering characters to be representatives of ideology beyond, as you're saying, Neytiri and cardboard cutout commander army man. Because I think it's interesting that like the rest of the characters also don't feel particularly memorable, because I don't know what they represent besides they're on team good or they're on team bad.
Like Michelle Rodriguez.
Exactly.
Like, yeah.
Yeah. Like, I forgot she was in this movie. I was like, all right, you're in this movie and you have like three scenes and you have an arc technically, because you're different at the end than you are in the beginning. I don't really understand why that happens.
Well, and even just a line of dialogue would go a long way in terms of the Jake character of like, you know, where I grew up, you know, nobody looked out for you, and the Na'vi, they look out for each other. Like, literally anything like that.
He's been looking for community.
He's just always some kind of hint that. Of yeah. He's being pushed along an arc. And I think that's why it's also hard to track, where the moments where he like goes against Quaritch and goes against his directives, right, or his mission or whatever, it's hard to track what those mean for him. Like when he gets up and makes those choices, I don't know what the cost is or what the personal like decision making is that's going into it. The personal stakes kind of feel like they've been left out of the movie in some ways.
And I don't want to like belabor the point, but I think it's also interesting that so much at the very beginning is made of, you know, because as you were saying, Brian, he doesn't have use of his legs in his human body, and then he gets an avatar body. It feels like that's so much of his initial like reason to be bought into this thing, that it almost feels like that's going to take be the foundation of something, but it's really not. That's just a thing that's, you know, a worthwhile, cool thing for him at the beginning, but then he falls in love with this world, and that's really what it's about. And like, as you're saying, there isn't that setup for why he would fall in love with this world or what's different about it. And so, yeah, it's this interesting thing where there's some stuff that's set up about him, but it's all very mechanical and then falls by the wayside pretty quickly.
Yeah. So,
yeah. Interesting protagonist. Can't wait to see him again. Alex, what's your last
Two quick things that I would not do. Say no to papyrus font.
Yeah.
And say no to using the exact same velociraptor. And I think I heard a T-Rex sound at one point.
Man.
Like,
yeah.
Just the literal Jurassic Park, like, samples of, like, the velociraptor yelping.
It's like, come on.
Like, repeatedly used for, like, the horses or whatever.
Yeah.
Like, you can't do that.
Right.
Anyway.
Yeah.
Those aside,
I'm with you. And the papyrus font is egregious.
It's just like, God damn it.
Yeah.
I guess my lesson would be, like, an appreciation of James Cameron truly pushing technology forward with this movie with performance capture. Because I think I didn't realize what a big deal this movie was for the thing that we take for granted now for, like, every movie, every video game, which is just the performance capture technology to really capture the facial performance of an actor, not just the body language, but those head-mounted cameras that really allow the every, you know, micro expression to come across in an animated character. And I think it's really interesting. There's also a meta aspect of this movie. Part of what feels so surreal about it is the kind of video gamey or cartoonishness of the world of Pandora. And it does feel like there is a meta thing happening here of the average Joe disheveled guy, you know, getting into a VR tank and waking up in this beautiful, amazing, impossibly gorgeous natural world. And it really struck me this time. It felt like a Ready Player One almost, or something where, like, Pandora feels so hyper real or hyper surreal or too colorful, too neon, too fluorescent. It gave me this feeling of, like, oh yeah, this really does function as kind of metaphor for escaping to virtual worlds and escaping from, you know, the dreary Earth industrial reality and getting back to this lost Eden that we don't have access to anymore on this planet. So anyway, appreciating both the technological advancement this movie represents, and also it seems like there is some meta awareness on Cameron's part of playing with just where we are, both in our civilization and kind of our nostalgia and, like, mourning for nature, and also the ascendancy of, like, virtual spaces and virtual worlds, and that being kind of our substitute for like the actual space around us being pleasant.
Pandora is gonna be the first place I go in the metaverse.
You're so close to making that
joke.
So
close.
Well, I think about, you know, there's a new PlayStation VR headset coming out soon, and, like, the killer game for that's going to be the Horizon VR, which is basically like a Pandora sci-fi magical world.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, I was definitely having Horizon Zero Dawn associations of, like, oh yeah, that's interesting.
Real quick, I think it's interesting, you know, we've talked about the sort of decade of movies becoming we can do anything now, and this is right at the end of that decade. And Cameron wanted to do, like, he had this idea 20 years before this movie was made or something, and then he was going to make it in the mid-aughts. But it's like, if you look at Terminator 2 and Jurassic Park, and then forward to Titanic, and then forward to Lord of the Rings, forward to, like, Children of Men, and, you know, some of these big, like, epics that we had around then, it almost felt like Avatar came right when we were kind of just getting used to everything. It was like, we really, because then it's like we already had, you know, Iron Man at that point. We had, like, and we were, you know, we had a bunch of, like, bad movies in, like, the mid-aughts and stuff. So it almost felt like if Avatar had come out 5 years earlier, it would have been just, like, we wouldn't have been able to believe what we were seeing. But it almost felt like,
right.
And this is nothing against the movie, nothing against the technology, but it's like, yeah, for as impressive as it was, it's like we just spent a decade going, we can do this now. We can do this now. We can do this now. And it was sort of like by the time Avatar came out, we're like, yeah, that's it's another one of them. It's another one of these. Look at what we can do now. And again, that's just a timing thing.
I'm going to call that wonder fatigue.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, it's true. Because it's like on the one hand, there's just the sheer amount of visual effects. I mean, it is like an animated movie, basically.
Oh, truly.
Is like overwhelming. But yeah, there are plenty of shots where it, you know, just there's a bunch of Na'vi hopping across a log and it doesn't feel great. You know, like compared to other movies that came out around that time, it doesn't feel any more impressive, honestly. This is the sheer scale of it is impressive and the performance capture is impressive.
Oh, yeah.
How much I feel like I'm watching a real person when I'm watching one of the main Na'vi characters. Like, that's the most important
thing. The faces are amazing.
Yeah.
Right. Like, the way that they move in the environment is not always perfect, but the facial expressions and the performances are outstanding.
And, like, the rendering of the skin technique. Yeah, like, it's a scale thing, like you're saying, Alex, where, like, there's enough bad shots that in my head I'm like, yeah, there's wrong stuff. But, like, the first shot where you see Neytiri and she, like, kind of stands up and the light, like, you can't, that shot couldn't be better. Like, it's just perfect.
There are so many standout shots where it's like, wait, this is weirdly good. Right. And then you have those, like, off-putting shots where it's like, the way they're bouncing around is, like, pretty not realistic.
And it's interesting that that model kind of became the norm then for forever, where it's like most visual effects now are like good and like passable, but because there's so many that have to be in any given Marvel movie, there's no budget or time to make any one spectacular.
It's the Jurassic Park thing where it's like Jurassic Park 1 is like, we're going to use this sparingly, so every time a T-Rex is on screen, it's going to look amazing. Right. And you fast forward to Jurassic World, you know, any of them. It's just like dinosaurs everywhere all of the time.
Yeah.
Right. We cannot make these look amazing. They're going to all look pretty blah.
Yeah. Brian, what's your lesson?
I mean, a lot of what we talked about, but I was thinking about what makes something feel three-dimensional, which, as you said, is ironic to think about with this movie. You know, we talk about with characters so much, right? Where it's like, yeah, you have a character archetype, but then you want to take that and make them interesting in some way, make them complex. What about them goes against their archetype, right? What's different about them? And, you know, the other end of the spectrum, you don't want to have a character who's like completely ununderstandable, where you never know what their objectives are, right? You kind of want something in the middle, something that feels familiar and new at the same time. And I was realizing, I think that's what it is about this movie, about this story, you know, not the movie itself in terms of the filmmaking and you know, the technical achievement, but the story that makes it fall flat is how much it feels all archetype. And Cameron has talked about like everything that he took from, right? And there's nothing wrong with that. There's nothing wrong with being like, here are my 20 favorite movies and books, and I wanted to remix them into something that was my own. But I was just realizing like every beat in this movie feels like I've seen it before, and not just because I've seen the movie before, but like when I saw it for the first time, it's like, not only does it feel like every other James Cameron movie, you know, it's like literally here's like the new, you know, soldier, and then here's all the other ones who want to talk crap, and then here's like the Vasquez / Michelle Rodriguez character, you know, and like here's the, you know, and even like Ridley Scott did this in Prometheus where it felt like he was trying to make like a James Cameron alien movie, right, where it's like Idris Elba with a cigar, that's now we have Sigourney Weaver with her goddamn cigarette, and it's just like everything feels like, yeah, I've seen all of these beats before. And you know, when it doesn't feel that way is when I'm the most interested. You know, the Na'vi and the idea of the avatars, the unexpected midpoint attack, some of the Pandora stuff, like those are the moments when I kind of lean forward a little bit because I'm going, oh, this is Avatar. This isn't every other movie I've already seen before, you know? So I was just thinking, yeah, if it's like, it's just like every element of filmmaking or storytelling, it's like find that thing that's kind of archetype enough that it's familiar, but also unfamiliar enough that it feels complex and it feels like something that is unique to you, right? It's like you've got the Steven Seagal B movie where everything feels like copy and pasted from every other movie. And then you have like some crazy, you know, Lars von Trier, Harmony Korine art film or whatever, where it feels like there is no structure, nothing is happening. I don't know what's going on, but it's like almost all of the best movies, feel like they are striking some balance in between, where every aspect of the filmmaking is like, this feels correct, but this also feels unique, and it feels like there's something kind of special about it. That's a very tall order, obviously, but I think I was realizing that almost so many aspects of this movie, specifically the screenwriting and the storytelling, and some of the character, a lot of the character design, is just, it's so normal that I think that's kind of why this movie doesn't feel exciting. You know, Trisha, you were like, this movie has really solid structure. And it's like, yep, it has very normal structure. You know what I mean? And again, where the attack happens, that's like the one time in the movie I'm going, oh, wow, I wasn't expecting this, because that's not where I expect that to happen in a movie. So yeah, just whatever, take that for whatever it's worth. It's just like, find that balance between the familiar and the unique.
I am really hoping, we'll see, maybe I shouldn't have any hope. I am really hoping that Way of Water will do something different than like the same structure as the first Avatar, because from what I understand, they are like migrating to like a different kind of Na'vi colony that has different ways. And I think it would be just like very exhausting if it was just literally learn the new ways of the new tribe, robots are coming to kill them, we have the same battle at the end. That might be exactly what this movie is, and maybe it'll look really cool because it's in the water, but I would love it if the movie could surprise me and be like, no, this is a James Cameron sequel. We are going to evolve the form and not just do it again. But I mean, he's making five of them or whatever, so who knows? Right.
But that is the cool thing about sequels, is that sequels tend to be able to go, okay, we've done the normal movie, now what? Right. You know, and James Cameron has made some amazing sequels by asking that exact question.
Yeah. Well, and I feel like all of this gets to the heart of this movie, that the puzzle at its core that I think just will never be able to be solved. It's like, it's for some reason this movie that I'm like, I don't know, but also I'm like, oh, yeah. And maybe, somehow, maybe, yeah. You know, it's like, these are lessons of like what to do and what not to do. But at the end of the day, it made $2 billion. It was the like most successful movie of all time for a very long time. Like, it's just really interesting to be trying to critically analyze something that was unambiguously successful, but also felt like it was missing something in a way that is ineffable.
I think it was back during the Oscar race in 2009 or something. People would ask me, you know, what do you think of Avatar? And I would go, it doesn't matter what I think. it truly doesn't matter what I think about Avatar. Like, you can't argue with money. Like, you can't argue with success. I don't know. Like, to an extent, you know, like, there are plenty of very successful movies that are bad. But at the same time, when they're this successful, there's kind of nothing you can say, because you can't say something doesn't work when it obviously does. when it just obviously does work for so many people. And, you know, we're driving at some of the reasons here, and, you know, we can hem and haw all we want, but when you combine a very simple, albeit maybe derivative and predictable story with some of these interesting elements, and especially some of these astounding visuals, you know, we talk about all the time, people come to media for different things. And a lot of what people come to film for is to sit in a chair and be immersed and amazed for a few hours. And damn, if Avatar isn't great at that.
Mm. I had a thought, Michael, when you were talking about, you know, for you personally, yeah, there's this weird disconnect. And I think, I mean, how much of that is aesthetic, is the design of the freaking Na'vi, where it's like they have the tails, they are weirdly too tall, they wear like thongs, like there's something about the design that just feels like so specific and so strange that I personally am never quite able to get over that hurdle and sink into this otherwise very like traditional classic epic movie. There's just something inexplicably odd and not quite right for my taste with some of the design choices. And I think that is like this, if that's not your reaction to the Na'vi, then I can get how this is just like a great, awesome popcorn blockbuster. But for me, there's this like, just, I can't quite get over the hurdle of the design choices.
Well, and I feel like that's just another example of something that like is exactly in this weird in between place for me, just like everything else about this movie, where like, yeah, it was shocking at first, but also like, do I have a crush on Blue Zoe Saldana? Yeah, I do. Like, I don't know what I'm supposed to do with that information about myself. And that is like unsettling.
Yeah.
But like, yeah, so I don't know. This movie, it's fascinating. It's going to be really fun. I'm excited to see The Way of Water for all the reasons that we've pointed out. I think there's a lot of cool potential there. I think whatever it's going to be fascinating to look at, to listen to, and to dissect, and just to be in a place where for the first time in 13 years, there's not just one Avatar movie. There's not this single thing. There's something else to hold next to it. And maybe that will render things more clearly and define things for us in a way that was, you know, as you said, Trisha, what we think about Avatar doesn't matter. Maybe it will soon. Who knows? In the meantime, what have you guys been watching, Brian?
I have been playing God of War Ragnarok, which I did not realize how appropriate it was to this conversation. You know, Alex has talked about the first game a ton, and I like the first game a lot, but the sequel just came out and I burned through it. And this one just really got me invested in the characters. And it's kind of exactly what we're talking about, where it's so epic and brutal, and then it can just make me care so much about this intimate father-son relationship. And all there's like this thematic core that all these characters and side stories are dealing with and stuff. So I was just constantly going from like this big adrenaline rush, I am a god, to fighting back tears and going like, oh, they love each other and they made a promise and they're keeping their promise and that it's a callback to earlier and I love you. So yeah, like once the game has been out for long enough, that people, anybody who's going to play it has played it, I want to like share some scenes on current social media platform. Because yeah, there's just some really truly beautiful moments. And I was not expecting this game to just like really get to me in all the ways that it did. And talking about earnestness, you know, the way Alex was saying, just like, it's this gruff main character who never wants to sort of say what he's thinking, but then when he does kind of like show a little bit of emotion, it's just, it's so huge and so powerful, and just like the love he has for his son, it's great. So yeah, that's what I've been spending many of my hours the past couple weeks doing.
Need more time to play video games. Awesome.
Yeah, I know. I'm very much looking forward to it. Looking forward to it even more. The original is great. Sounds like it's, yeah, just that much better. Awesome.
Also, Richard Schiff is Odin, and it's the most inspired casting choice ever. He just plays it like Richard Schiff, and it's incredible. It's so good.
Wow.
Yeah. That was funny. There was, yeah, a week recently where Brian spoiled surprise Richard Schiff for me twice.
Yeah.
There was, wow, surprise Richard Schiff in Black Panther and God of War. Awesome. Okay. Alex, what have you been watching?
I have been watching 1899 on Netflix, which is the new series from the creators of Dark, which I made all of you watch for the podcast.
Trisha, you're welcome, you Trisha. That?
Wait, what? Watch out.
Yeah, you know, they're German creators, and you know, I was a huge fan of Dark because it was the most ambitious time travel story I've seen attempted. You know, maybe didn't quite succeed in the end in all the ways, but it's really ambitious, and this show, I don't know where it's going. I've only watched the first couple episodes, but it seems equally ambitious in its goals. I don't know what those goals are yet, but it's got a great international cast. stunning production values, beautiful cinematography, great music, all the same things Dark had. So if you like Dark, I think you're gonna like 1899, and it's the same writer, same director. So it's the whole team back together again. And adult Jonas is one of the main characters.
Ooh, he's interesting.
Trisha, you might like the setting at least. It's like a period piece, obviously, on like a Titanic style kind of ship crossing the Atlantic.
Okay, I do like that as a setting. Yeah.
But it's a lot, it's very mystery boxy.
Okay.
Very mystery box.
Nice. Okay, Trisha, what have you been watching?
I'm also watching a Netflix series. I am watching season 5 of The Crown, and I am so thrilled that it's out. I have adored that show since the beginning. So for those that don't know, The Crown is about the 20th century English monarchs and basically the royal family. And the interesting thing about the show is that every 2 seasons, they totally recast the show. So, you know, in the first season, you had Claire Foy, who was playing the young Queen Elizabeth. And then in the next 2 seasons, you had Olivia Colman playing her in middle age. And in season 5 and what will be season 6, you have Imelda Staunton, the incredible Imelda Staunton, playing her. And this cast is like, so they've recast everybody. And so this season 5 is like a totally new version of characters that we've spent a lot of time with already. So you have Imelda Staunton playing the queen, and then Jonathan Pryce is playing Prince Philip, which is great. Dominic West, who I adore, is playing Prince Charles, and he's very good in this. Charles is still the worst, but Dominic West is doing a great job. and Elizabeth Debicki is playing Princess Diana. And aside from being, you know, 6'5", she, which the show doesn't bother to explain,
she wears her heels on her knees.
She's suddenly very tall.
Well, in fairness, I looked it up. I was like, Diana was 5'10". So she was on the tall side. But yeah, anyway, but Elizabeth Debicki is doing an incredible job as well. So, you know, there's a lot of tragedy in the royal family. We're in the 90s right now. So there's a lot of like everybody's marriages are broken and lots of tragedy is happening everywhere, or just like personal pain and drama. But the show is still absolutely excellent. And so highly recommend. I know we talked you into watching The Crown, Michael. And so I'm excited to hear what you think of season 5.
I'm very excited to start.
Talk about production value. I mean, that show is like, holy crap. It must be so expensive. It's one of their most expensive shows, sure. Right?
Yeah, yeah, but the money is so up on gorgeous. Screen. It's,
yeah. Yeah.
I'm going to miss Olivia Colman, though. I take umbrage to Mel.
No, you do not. There it is. Umbrage.
She's great. I did. At first, I was really sad about losing Olivia Colman, but she won me over.
Yeah.
Nice. Yeah. Can't wait to start. Awesome.
Michael?
So I am visiting my mother for the holidays on the drive up here. I listened to a podcast called K63, which is a Spotify podcast. It's an adaptation of their Spanish language Latin American podcast that came out a couple years ago, I think. And so it's like 9 episodes. They're all pretty short, and it basically follows the story of a psychiatrist played by Julianne Moore recording the sessions of this kind of enigmatic patient referred to as Case 63, played by Oscar Isaac, who claims to be a time traveler from the year 2062. And so it's this kind of radio play style where it's all these kind of recordings of their sessions. And it's largely just the two of them having dialogue scenes, and there's the sci-fi-ness of it where he's claiming to be a time traveler and he's here for a reason. It's self-aware. It's like it exists in a world in which Back to the Future is a movie that like he's watched. And also it's a really interesting story world. It's executed very well. It's so much fun to watch Julianne Moore and Oscar Isaac have, you know, this rapport and to have these long dialogue scenes together. And so it's kind of right in the nice zone of bite size, but still filling and gripping. And I binged it all and very much enjoyed it. So K63 on Spotify podcast.
Nice.
Very cool. I've been interested in the like narrative podcasts, but I never quite got into it. I tried a couple and could never, you know, so, but that one sounds like a good one.
This one's short and the episodes are short too. I listened to it also on my drive and yeah, it's like 9 to 12 minute episodes and there's just like 10 of them. So it's,
oh, nice.
You can totally binge it.
Very cool.
Yeah. No, it was cool. Made me excited about this form. Like, oh, this is good. Good work, everybody. Well, this has been our conversation about Avatar. Our upcoming conversation about The Way of Water will be coming to the Beyond the Screenplay Patreon as a patron exclusive. It's going to be a lot of fun. Alex, Trish, and I are going to go see it in IMAX 3D. I don't know where Brian is. He's going to be somewhere else, but presumably
literally no idea what city I'll be in that time.
But we'll all be on Pandora.
There it is.
Right? Because mm-hmm. we're going back to Pandora. It's still on Pandora,
yeah.
right?
Yeah,
it's not Pandora. A new planet or yeah. anything. Okay,
no. Great. But we're in the water now.
We're in the water. It's a whole new world. And for our next episode, 'Tis the Season, we will be talking about Elf.
Yay!
Yay!
A movie that I have never seen.
Oh, so excited for you, Michael. So
Elf. This will be my first experience into Will Ferrell doing stuff. Is all I know about it. He's an elf, I guess.
Yep, you got it.
Great. John Favreau also, right?
Correct. Mm-hmm.
Directed? Yeah. Yeah. Cool. So next episode is Elf. This has been our conversation about Avatar, Way of Water, patron exclusive, coming soon. Want to say a big thank you to our patrons for making this show possible. Thank you to our producer, Vince Major, and our editors, Caleb Berg, Graham Harthorn, and Eric Schneider. I'm Michael Tucker, and I've been joined today by Trisha Rand, Brian Bittner, and Alex Kayeros. All of our Twitter handles are in the show notes. Send us a tweet and say hi. And we will see you in the next episode for Elf.
Bye, everybody.
Bye-bye.
Bye.